My name is Professor Sandra Thompson. I'm on the staff here, on the faculty at the University of Houston Law Center, and I'm the director of the Criminal Justice Institute here. And I'm delighted to introduce our guest speaker for today, Ms. Denise Onken. Ms. Onken is a native Houstonian. She's been an assistant district attorney with the Harris County District Attorney's Office here in Houston for the past 22 years. She started when she was very, very young.
Very young.
She has specialized in prosecuting crimes against children and has been a chief of the Child Abuse Division for 14 years. During her tenure, the division has grown from a paid staff of 5 to 16. She's a veteran prosecutor, having been assigned a number of positions, including chief of a district court, handling capital murder cases, and a special prosecutor in the Special Crimes Division Drug Task Force. She serves on numerous child abuse boards and committees and is a frequent speaker at child abuse seminars and conferences. She's prosecuted thousands of cases with her expertise in child abuse. She's an honor graduate of the University of Houston with a bachelor's and master's in business, and she's a 1985 graduate of South Texas College of Law. She serves on several child abuse-related committees, task forces, and councils. She's received the Children's Hope Award in 2000, which was presented by Interfaith Ministries Youth Victim Witness Program. She was nominated in 2002 for the Award for Distinguished Service to Children and Families by the State Bar of Texas. She's been appointed and currently serves as the past chair of the State of Texas Child Fatality Review Team Committee. And she's also received the 2002 Children's Advocacy Centers of Texas Team Excellence Award for prosecution. She's also on the advisory board of the Criminal Justice Institute, for which I'm especially grateful. And with no further ado, Denise Onken.
Thank you very much. Gosh, it sounds like I've done a lot, and the 22 years have really gone fast. I know anytime I speak to a group of students, you're thinking, oh my gosh, she's been doing that 22 years. How could you possibly stay at the DA's office that long? And you know, when I started, initially when you start as an assistant DA, in the past there's been like a 3-year commitment because of the training and things like that that you go through. And the reason I've stayed so long is because every day is interesting. And as you practice law and what area you practice in, the most important thing is to make sure that you really enjoy going to work every day and what you're doing in the practice of law. So remember that as you choose your careers and things like that, because I do still enjoy going to the office every day. Just when I think I've seen every kind of case that you can see, oh no, there's something new, something different, and the law keeps changing. You know, certainly your professor and the other practicing lawyers here realize that, but the law does keep changing. So, you know, just because you graduate from law school, you don't put those law books away. It changes and you keep having to be up on the new laws and things like that. So what I'm going to talk to you about today is a little bit about what I do at the DA's office, and that is child victim testimony, or presenting child victim testimony. In the Child Abuse Division at the DA's office, that's what we do. We prosecute mainly sexual abuse cases involving children. We do some physical abuse as well, but the reason we've got 7 lawyers there, we can't handle all the child abuse cases. So the harder ones are the child sexual abuse, and that's what we do in that division. I just want to tell you a little bit, because I know some of you, have some of you interned at the DA's office or ever worked at the DA's office? One? Couple?
Three.
Okay. Three? All right. For those of you who haven't, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what occurs before we get the case at the DA's office. First of all, what happens is a child will outcry about sexual abuse. They'll tell somebody at school, a friend, family member, whatever, that they've been sexually abused by somebody. So how does it get to us at the DA's office? What happens is that the police and or CPS are contacted by someone who realizes, oh, this needs to be reported that a child has been sexually abused. So it's a dual reporting system. If they're too afraid to call 911 or the police, they can call the 1-800 hotline for CPS and it will get reported to police. Our case comes from the police investigation. CPS may be doing an investigation, custody may be yanked, pulled whatever direction, but we get our investigation from the police. They do communicate with CPS, we do get information from them, but it's the police investigation that drives the filing of our case. The police then will get the report of a child's been sexually abused. Typically, and when a child is involved, they've got to get the child interviewed. That's part of the investigation. How does that happen? Well, it can happen several ways. The preferred way, and what happens the majority of the time, is the child has a recorded forensic interview that is done. Typically, it's done at the Children's Assessment Center. Does anybody know what the Children's Assessment Center is? Several of you? Anybody ever been out there? Several of you have. They've got about five or six forensic interviewers, some bilingual. Typically, a child is brought in and an interview is done by one of the forensic interviewers. They are not employed by police. They're not employed by my office. They're employed by the Children's Assessment Center, which is an advocacy center in the state of Texas. It's over in the Rice Village area. If you're ever over in that area, it's a three-story building. Very child-friendly inside. You just kind of have that warm, nice feeling when you go in. You don't have that institutional feeling like we do at some of the universities or when you come down to the courthouse. It's not that institutional feeling. It's more a child-friendly kind of place. But it is a three-story, it's a fairly good-sized building. They're brought in, the police will have them interviewed by the forensic interviewer. The police are not in the room or CPS in the room when they're interviewed. They can see the interview through closed circuit in the next room. It's over a TV. It's not a two-way mirror like in the old style stuff. It's closed circuit. And they can watch the interview at that time. I can also watch the interview at that time, or any of the lawyers in my area or at the DA's office at the same time, because we now have a new digitized system that allows us through a secure internet site to view those interviews, either at the time they're occurring or later on. It's typically later on when we review, unless it's something very unusual, we're not necessarily viewing it at the time when it happens, mainly because volume. There's a lot of volume that occurs. There's between 2,500 to 3,000 child abuse cases, that's sexual abuse, physical abuse, and other types of child abuse cases filed, felony cases in Harris County each year. So you can see with the volume, we don't really have the time to sit around and necessarily review the interview until it's determined by police there is a good viable charge here and that we actually file charges. So the child's interviewed, a medical exam is typically done on the child. That can typically be done at the Children's Assessment Center as well. Oftentimes these cases that come from kids are delayed outcry. They're not like, 5 minutes ago I got sexually abused. They may be a several year delayed outcry. Still, typically a medical exam will be done just to ensure, that the kid is okay and to determine if there is any type of medical evidence. It also gives us a medical expert who has reviewed the genitalia of the child to determine if there's anything there. Police also talk with any other witnesses. There may not be eyewitnesses to the abuse, but there are witnesses who have either lived with the child, who the child has outcried to. They'll talk to, if they've outcried at school, the teachers. They'll interview family members. And their investigation will go in that regard. Now, everybody watches CSI. So the question is, how many other cases do you get that kind of evidence as well? Not very many. Delayed outcry, 2 years. Sexual abuse occurred at an apartment that the perpetrator lived in at that time. They've moved on, apartment's been released, so on and so forth. We're not gonna get any DNA evidence. And that's typically what you find in cases. Every once in a while, we will have a relatively close in time outcry. We will get some DNA evidence that will be evaluated by one of several different entities that do the DNA analysis, depending upon the particular police agency, whether it's HPD, Sheriff, Pasadena. There's 30 plus police agencies in Harris County. So once all of those kinds of things are looked at and done, the investigating officer will also contact the suspect in the case. They'll want to typically do a non-custodial interview with the suspect, unless there are some high-risk concerns. Perpetrator's in the house with the child, the sexual abuse just occurred yesterday. or there are some concerns that they may flee the jurisdiction, either out of the country or flee the state or something like that. Some of those kind of issues. But typically on these kind of cases, we have the non-custodial interviews that the officers will do. Typically those are recorded, and in those interviews, sometimes they admit, sometimes they deny that anything happened. And depending upon if there's any reason to believe that there might be some DNA, the officers might ask for consent for maybe a buccal swab or something like that. At that time, too, the officers may use an investigative tool, the polygraph. Not in every case. And sometimes they'll do it at that time, or they'll reschedule it at a later time. Typically, if the defendant has subsequently obtained a lawyer after they visit with the officer initially, typically they're not submitting to those polygraphs. And the polygraphs are simply a tool in the case. They don't really affect our charging decision. They're an investigative tool for the officer. So once the officer completes their entire investigation, that's when they come to us. The DA's office, we have DAs that go out to the Children's Assessment Center one day a week, rotating. We also have our 24/7 intake, and we also have prosecutors in the division that are on call to receive those calls from officers when they have a charge they want to be reviewed. We do accept, I said, between 25 to 3,000 charges a year. That doesn't include those that might go initially direct to a grand jury, that might be sent back for further investigation before we will accept charges, or those that we decline charges on outright. So that's a good additional number as well. So a DA sits down with the officer, typically reviews the case. The officer will summarize. Sometimes we'll look at parts of the interview or even the complete interview of the child, depending upon what's going on. Sometimes we'll look at the interview of the suspect, if there is one, and review any other records that they might have, therapy records or school records or things like that, depending upon what goes on. Case gets to us, and once charges are accepted, then we get to our involvement with the child at that point in time. Now, typically what we do when we first get the case is we review the child interview, the one that I told you is on our digitized or secure internet site. We can pull that up and review it, and that gives us an idea of what the kid's saying happened. Now, typically in the police report, that may be summarized for us as well. We review other recorded or written statements that the officer has. And we typically can evaluate what the cases were, what our evidence really is at that point in time, so that we can make some type of offer on the case. Sometimes we may need to get the child in order to clarify things. The forensic interviewers do a pretty good job, but every once in a while we've got some questions, as lawyers may have, about what happened. Maybe there's additional details we want. Maybe they didn't cover, with the new technology, some issues in regard to computers or cell phones or things like that, or some other evidence that has come up after the forensic interview has been done. So at that point in time, we may get the child in and we'll visit with them. Typically, we visit with them downtown at our offices. We have some child-friendly interview rooms that we have, kind of different age group levels for the little kids, 3, 4, 5, elementary school level, more of a kind of a living room format. And then we've got some that's more of a table or interview room when we talk with teenagers sometimes. Sometimes when we visit with teenagers, we may need to look at their MySpace page or something like that. So we've got a computer in there that we can access that, because we want to know if there's anything bad out there about that child that we should know. So we take a look at those things. Here's what we do when we interview a child. I mean, basically, we're meeting with them, and when we sit down to visit with the child, we have reviewed, of course, their recorded statement. So we're familiar with how they talk, how they look, how they acted in that interview, and we sit down with them. Typically what I like to do is warm them up a little bit, ask them about how their day's going, if they're in school, what's been going on at school, what do you like to do in your off time from school, if it's summertime, what have you been doing this summer, just to kind of get a feel and just talk to them a little bit, warm them up a little bit. Sometimes it can be a little intimidating. Sometimes I'm dressed like I'm dressed right today, solid black suit. You know, it can be a little intimidating for kids. Maybe I've just walked from the courtroom and dealing with lawyers. And so you want to warm them up a little bit. Have them realize that you're not a big bad person or anything like that. You just want to get to the bottom of what happened to them, who might have hurt them. And so warm them up a little bit. And then you do want to talk about the sexual abuse that's occurred. And there's different approaches with different kids. I've had the kids who come in and they don't want to say anything at all about it. I've had the kids who moved over to the edge of the couch or gone to the corner of the room and curled up in a fetal position. And, you know, I remember those instances probably more so than others because I remember one time I had a paralegal sitting in with me and the child was small, probably 4 or 5 years old. It was a child who had been sexually abused by when she had gone to, she had broken her arm and she had gone to one of the children's hospitals here in Houston and was being sexually abused when she went in the x-ray room. Mama had to wait outside because there were several kids with her. And so that's when it happened. And she didn't want to talk at all. And I remember my paralegal telling me, there's no way you're going to be able to get this kid to talk. And I said, well, let's give her a little bit of time. So we tried to talk to her a little bit. Typically, I don't ever have the parents come in the interview room, but I thought it might help because she was 4 or 5 at the time. Had Mama come in there, she just, you know, sat on Mama's lap and hit her face and wouldn't talk at all. Thought that won't work. And then we talked to, she would talk about other stuff. I got her to talk about pets or fun stuff or playgrounds or whatever the popular toy was at the time. So we talked about that, and I didn't push her that first time. Typically, I usually never meet with a kid more than like twice before a trial, mainly because I've done this so much and can get a pretty quick feel. But she came back the next time, and the next time her dad came with her, same thing, she went in the room, just wouldn't talk about it at all. I had Dad come in there for a little while. She sat on his lap, and I kept talking to her while he was sitting on his lap. We were talking about other stuff. Then I just moved into the sexual abuse about when she went to the hospital for a broken arm. And she said, yeah, I broke my arm. And we talked about how you broke your arm. And we just moved right into it. And I felt really bad for the dad because I had told him before we went in, I'll have you sit in there so she's more comfortable, but she cannot say a word during the time that we're in there. So it's very hard for him because this was really the first time he heard her talk about what happened. She was able to talk about it. And actually, when we got to trial time, she was able to sit in her room and talk about it and didn't necessarily have to have her parents there. But, you know, sometimes you just have to do what works with an individual child. And it's highly unusual for me to bring a parent in for that kind of situation. But other kinds of cases involving other older kids, sometimes we have oftentimes special needs kids. You know, we've had hearing impaired, those with learning disabilities. Learning disabilities are very interesting too because you really have to assess. I mean, we have records you review ahead of time, but you have to remember we're lawyers first. We didn't necessarily major in child development. We've taken some classes in that regard, but we're not experts in that regard. And we've got to talk to this kid, and we've got to assess whether this 7-year-old is really functioning on a 7-year-old level or really functioning more on a 3-year-old level. Or if we've got a 13-year-old, whether they're really functioning more on a 5 or 6-year-old level. And so you really have to assess that because that really determines how you ask the questions of the children, how you're going to assess truth or a lie from them. And that's one of the important things we have to determine. If it's an older kid, typically I go, hey, what's the difference between a truth and a lie? And they go ahead and let me know, here's what a truth means, here's what a lie means. It's good to tell the truth, bad to tell the lie. But sometimes you'll get children who might be a little behind developmentally, and they don't know the definitions like that. Typically, you can get an elementary school-aged kid who's going to be able to tell you truth is good, here's what it is, lie is bad, that's what happens if you tell a lie. Sometimes you'll get them and they won't have that conceptual issue. Doesn't mean that they're not competent for court purposes and can't tell you what happened to them. They just don't have that conceptual issue. So you use other kinds of things to determine that. One of the popular things is colors. You know, if I said to them, hey, I'm wearing a lime green shirt today, is that correct or is that wrong? Well, you have to remember, too, some kids developmentally don't know their colors. Even though they may be a little older and you expect by the time they start school, they know their colors. So you really kind of have to back up with other things. So, you know, if you know, if you don't want to use colors, then you might have to go, today I've got a pin here on my jacket. Is that right or is that wrong? Kind of thing. So that they can tell you that it's a truth or a lie, so you're able to determine those kind of things. So you really have to back up based upon what you're dealing with child-wise. We also have kids who have some psychological issues, too, who've been sexually abused. None of us are psychologists in the child abuse division. We put on lots of different experts who talk about it. We've been to some trainings where they talk about it, but we're not psychologists. We're not therapists. And so when we read the records and we see we've got a kid who may be bipolar, ADHD, and has some emotional disturbances, that will usually, unless they've had some personal experience dealing with kids like that, makes the lawyers a little, oh my gosh, you know, how am I ever going to talk to this kid? And just to give you an example, one of the lawyers who came into my area, and she had actually interned when she was in law school, and then as she rose through the ranks at the DA's office, came back and was a special prosecutor in our division. And she came to me and she said, you know, I've talked with the therapist and they just really think I'm not going to be able to put this child on. He had several issues, ADHD, emotional disturbances, and several other diagnoses that were problems. I said, well, does the kid go to school? Yeah, he goes to school. I said, well, you know, we ought to just meet with him and just, you know, see if he can talk to us a little bit about anything. And we did. And when we first sat in the room, I felt the other lawyer, she was very nervous about even beginning a conversation with him. You know, didn't want to cause any other psychological trauma. So I just started to talk to him about, you know, hey, what's been going on today? And I think he brought a toy with him, or so we talked about that. And realized that this is a kid who's kind of hyper. He had some emotional disturbances and things like that. But he could talk like any other kid could talk. And we moved into the sexual abuse. And, you know, after we did some warming up, moved into the sexual abuse, and he was able to tell me about it. The other lawyer that was sitting with me was pretty shocked that he was able to disclose, and I think even the therapist, after we visited with them afterwards, were surprised that he opened up as much as he did. But part of it is, with kids, I find, you just have to remember they're people, and you have to talk to them like you would anybody else. And we, as lawyers, can't be afraid to talk to him because this is our primary witness in the case. We can't be afraid. Yeah, a lot of these psychological diagnoses that they get is a little intimidating at first. We might not understand all the ramifications of it, but that's why we put the experts on in the case, to really explain that. And sometimes if we have some issues understanding why they could talk about this, couldn't talk about this, why this is related this way, sometimes the therapist or the psychologist help us understand that. But it's real important to realize they are people, and you just have to talk to them like anybody else. It's kind of like if you meet an adult who's had some psychological issues over their life. You might be a little bit, oh my goodness, I don't really know how to approach them, but they're a person. So you sit down and you talk with them. And I will tell you, by the time we were getting trial ready on that case, the other lawyer, I was a little late, couldn't get to the meeting quite on time. I was tied up in another meeting. And so she went in and started meeting with the kid because he was ADHD and hyper, and you need to get in there and get going with them because their attention span is fairly limited. She got in there, and she had realized, because he was kind of bouncy that day, that she needed to be in fairly close proximity to him. So she was probably sitting about 3 feet from him. She had his chair facing her chair. There were other people in the room with him, another paralegal, a court advocate, so on and so forth. But she had him focused on her, and they were talking, and they were going through what had happened and what the testimony was going to be like when they were going to be in trial. And so it was a world of difference. That lawyer had come 180 degrees from that first time that we sat in the interview room with the child. So, you know, I tell you that just to say that if you're ever faced with the situation, especially in a criminal case of talking to a child, they're just people, and you just talk to them in that regard. One of the things that I always like to tell people about as a prosecutor and a lawyer dealing with a child is you can't get too chummy with them. You're not their buddy. You know, there's other people to do that. There's the court advocates. There's children's court services we deal with. There are other people who are their buddies. You're the one who is putting them on. You're making sure that they are telling the truth in court about what happened. And so you have to be careful, too, because of certain emotional issues about hugging them or touching them. Typically, I tell a lawyer, you never initiate a touch with a child, even a handshake or a high five, unless they want to go that direction, because you're not sure what personal barriers have been invaded in the abuse that's occurred to them. And so you have to be very, very aware of that. Now, you'll have some kids who, you know, want to give you a high five right away or something like that, or some children who will want to come over and give you a hug. You can't just, you know, push them back or something like that. You have to be receptive. It's kind of like teachers in school. You know, some schools have certain rules about to what extent you can hug a child or anything like that. So you kind of have to play it by ear. And if they've got certain special needs, sometimes if they want to sit on your lap or something like that, that's clearly inappropriate, and you're going to have to say, no, we don't do that when we talk. We're lawyers, and so that's not our role. You know, maybe somebody else later can do that with you afterwards, but not right now. So you have to think about all those kinds of things, and it's not something you're necessarily thinking about when you're dealing with adult witnesses or things like that. Another big issue that has occurred in child sexual abuse cases is recantation. Has everybody heard about that? Child recants. Many, many reasons that a child recants. One reason may be because it really didn't happen. And so now they're telling the truth. It really didn't happen. I made it up for whatever reason. And that's typically going to occur more with a teenage, where they can kind of put all these pieces together kind of thing. A little kid, it's going to be too hard typically. Other reasons may be there may be some family pressure, since the child has told about the sexual abuse. You know, the perpetrator's been put in jail, or maybe they're not receiving income from him, and so life isn't very good. They've had to move out of their house. They're now living in not so good a place, or with some other friends, or things like that. Or a child has been put in CPS custody. There's a multitude of things. And so if a child recants, and typically if a defense lawyer comes to us and says, hey, you can't prove your case, the child is recanting. Now the defense lawyers have gotten pretty smart. They'll have the child brought in. If mother's supportive of the perpetrator, mother will bring the child to them, and they'll record that with the child. Typically they'll let us listen to it and we'll hear it. And you may think, well, the case is over at that point. Not necessarily. Recently we had a case where one of the lawyers had that kind of situation occur, and so the lawyer said, fine, let me get the kid in one more time, visit with them, and you know, see what the bottom line is on this. Child comes in, visiting with the child. The child is not talking about the sexual abuse. No, it didn't happen, just like on the recording. However, on their initial forensic interview, they had told many details about the sexual abuse, and they were a small child. Well, as the lawyer was talking to him, they noticed that the kid had some writing on their hands and stuff like that. He noticed it because his kid is small and likes to write on herself or draw pictures on herself or whatever. And so he was asking the child about, you know, oh, you got some writing on there, and looked at it. And then he looked at the other hand and he said, and it had the perpetrator's name on there, something to the effect of bring this person home was written. Bring first name of that person home, palm of her hand, kind of sweaty. And the lawyer, in thinking about it, had the child do something or draw something on a paper for him, realized that the child was right-handed or left-handed, I don't remember, and for them to have written it on the other hand, it would have been their other hand, and the writing was clear. He could clearly read it. And so he asked the child about who wrote that on there, and was able to determine that it was the mother who wrote that on there. So, you know, sometimes you just have to be very aware. And, you know, that's not anything that had ever come up in any other case that I've ever been aware of. And so you just have to be very perceptive of those kinds of things. We've had some recantation cases where the children, you know, come back and say, you're right, I said it didn't happen, but it really did. We had one just last week where the lawyer went to the school with with one of the investigators or whatever, and the child started crying and said, yeah, it really did happen. I said it didn't because so-and-so didn't want me to. But we also have those cases where the kids are not going to come back around. They've recanted. They're sticking with it, even though they had a lot of details. They may or may not have been in therapy, but when we review it with the experts, they say this is clearly too much detail for a child this age. These are the family pressures that we're able to ascertain through investigation or so on and so forth. And so we've actually tried those cases and have obtained convictions in some of those cases. So very interesting, because sometimes the kids have issues. So anyway, that issue comes up on habeas issues and things like that as well. So that kind of gives you an idea. And 1 o'clock is when this is over. I want to move to some of these case studies I have here. Let me just see if there was anything else. Oh, one of the things we do with the kid is talk about the court system a little bit, because typically we will have them taken to the courtroom so they can see it. It's kind of like the first time any of you might have walked in a courtroom. I remember my first time. I was actually, I don't know if I was in law school or pre-law school, the first time I actually walked in a real courtroom from seeing it on TV. But we take them in the courtroom and let them walk around. It's typically an empty courtroom. We let them walk around and get familiar with where the witness is going to sit, where they're going to sit, where the lawyers sit, where the judge sits, where the jury sits, where the clerks are sitting, and that they've got computers they're working on during testimony going on and things like that. If there's technology in there, kids love that. You'll show them like the screen that they've got, if they've got to mark or write anything on or anything like that, you'll show them some of the technology. Microphones, things like that. Some kids have talked into microphones, some have not. If you haven't ever heard your voice on a microphone before, for the little kids, sometimes they're like, you know, then they'll want to be like screaming into it. So you get that out of the way before the trial. So typically, I don't necessarily take them to the courtroom myself. Once again, volume is a problem for us. So we have, it's a nonprofit agency that works with the kids that are their court advocates. They're very well versed on it. We have a DVD for like the teenage level to talk about the court system. A lot of them have already had judicial or court kind of stuff in school, so they understand the prelims. Little kids don't even like really get what the courtroom is, you know. And so they have a coloring book and things like that they go over with them. And they take them to the courtroom. So we'll ask them, did you go up and look at the courtroom? So unless I'm worried about a particular kid in the courtroom, typically they'll do that because of volume. Smaller jurisdictions, you'll find that the lawyer themselves will take them there. Typically, I don't do it because I think we have pretty good group to do it. And I'm comfortable with even support staff taking them to show them the courtroom and stuff like that. And like I said, typically, to put a child on the witness stand, you know, if I meet with them 2 times, that's usually max before trial. And you may think, oh my gosh, how can you do that? It's from having done it lots of times. It's from not being afraid of the kid when you put him on the witness stand. You might have gone over a lot of the details with him, but maybe there's some you haven't. I remember one case I tried, and it came up on cross-examination. The kid was like 9, and defense was asking the kid, well, you know, wasn't this a dream? Wasn't this really a dream? Because it happened in the nighttime or bedtime arena when the child was sexually abused. And the kid was agreeing with that. And I remember the lawyer who was sitting with me, they really tensed up and thought, oh no, we've lost the case now. The kid has said it's a dream. I said, you know, and they're like, you're not gonna redirect him. And I'm like, oh yeah, I can't let that sit. We need to go in and explore that a little bit. And of course the other lawyer knew I had never talked to the kid about dreams or anything like that. And so basically I'm talking to this child for the first time about the dream. You know, you, a few minutes ago you just said that it was a dream when this happened. Let's talk about that. Was it really a dream, or were you awake? Did you know it happened? And so anyway, we did a bunch of questions and we walked through that, and I could feel the lawyer next to me, they were just like, you know, she got through it because they were so tense, thinking that, yeah, it was a dream. It was all a dream. I've dreamed the whole thing. And so, but it's kind of being comfortable with whatever comes out. And if the kid had said, yeah, it was a dream, it was all a dream, we would have dealt with it and either proceeded with the case or done away with it at that point in time. But you can't be afraid to go there. It's like any time you're doing the direct or a cross of a witness. Sometimes, and typically, we always like to know the answer before we ask the question, but this was a situation where I had met with the kid a couple of times, so I was fairly comfortable with her. You know, she had told me that this had happened. I just felt like if it was really a dream, she would have mentioned that, or maybe something would have come out that would have clued me in that was an issue. But anyway, she did fine and said no, it wasn't a dream. It really did happen. Yeah, I told the fence that, but, you know, they were kind of leading her down the primrose path. So she did well in responding. Another question that I get before I talk about a couple of these case studies is, do you practice the questions with the kids? Well, you know, from that last example, I don't get to practice all the questions. I don't. In fact, I will tell you, with adult witnesses, sometimes you have to practice a little bit more with them because they're more nervous than the kids are. In other words, you know, you can tell a kid, okay, when you get on the witness stand, I'm going to ask you your name, and then I'm going to ask you, you know, where you go to school, and then I'm going to ask you about what happened when, you know, the perpetrator, whoever that is, did this to you. And they may have told me about it, and I said, you know, and if you're asked, did I tell you what to say? Did I tell you what to say? And the kid will kind of look at me, and I said, well, was I there? And when you came into my office the first time, was I able to tell you what happened, or did you have to tell me because I wasn't there? And they go, well, I had to tell you because you weren't there, kind of thing. So, you know, kids are just real interesting entities, and I don't practice the questions with them. Sometimes even more for our experts. It's like you have to prepare the experts a little bit more for the line of questioning that you're going in. But kids, as long as they know what happened to them, it was their life. It's what happened to them. They can answer those questions. And cross-examination, that's another question I get. Do you practice kids undergoing cross-examination? Typically not. I don't want to scare them. The lawyer on the other side, the lawyer may be very nice to them. I will tell them to listen carefully to the question. They may be a little nervous in the courtroom, but just listen carefully to the question. And if they don't understand the question, don't just answer it. Say, can you say that again? Or something like that. And I always tell them, you know what, I do that a lot. If a judge tells me something and I don't understand, I tell them, you know, can you explain that again? Or I said, there's nothing wrong with that. It's not that you look stupid or that you missed it. It's okay. I do it all the time. And it really does make them more comfortable because typically I'll see the kids, they'll, you know, there'll be some convoluted question, as lawyers, we all do. And, you know, I don't really understand it either, what they're getting at. And so the kid will go, I don't understand that. So then they'll have to ask the question again. So it's just making them more comfortable. So cross-examination, I don't practice that. I just let them know it's okay to say, I don't understand. Can you repeat that? Or can you say it differently? Or I don't understand what you're asking. So that they will ask it again. Any questions? Oh, okay. I have a number of case studies, but I'm only going to do a couple, and actually I'm going to try to forward to one, a case that I just did like last week, I think we did. Let me just see if I can find it. This is it. This is a case study. One of the things that I was asked to talk about a couple of weeks ago when we did a Protecting Child conference was on teachers as perpetrators. We have a lot of elementary, middle school, and high school teachers who have been sexual perpetrators of students or children. And this is kind of it always gets a lot of media attention and things like that. And so I did a team presentation with one of the lead psychologist at the Children's Assessment Center on this issue. He studied it quite a bit. I've handled a number of these cases and we've kind of watched them because of the attention that they get. This is a case involving, she was an elementary school teacher a couple of years ago at Piney Point Elementary in Houston Independent School District, fifth grade social studies teacher. And the victims in the case were five fifth grade male students, ages 11 to 14 at the time that they, well, actually 11 to 13 at the time that they were sexually abused. The boys did not outcry until they were like 7th or 8th grade. So you can see it was quite a period of time, and it was one boy who initially outcried. What happened was, this was a case investigated by the Houston Police Department. The relationship began in her classroom. It was a fifth grade classroom. A lot of the students, in fact, all of the victims that we had in the case, of course, were male students. Most of them, English as a second language. So that was very interesting. She started flirting with the boys. She didn't have a very good control of discipline in the classroom. And a lot of the fondling occurred in the classroom with all the other students there. And when you first hear that, you're thinking, okay, how could this be happening? You got other kids in there. You got a class of 20 plus students, and she's fondling other kids. You know, and if you listen to the kids when they tell you about it, she had her desk, and they'd be like crawling under her desk, and these are fifth graders, and she'd be letting them touch her breast under the desk, and they'd be touching her private parts under there, and there was a lot of fondling going on. She was even touching them when they'd get under there. So a lot of those kind of things going on. There was also a closet adjacent or right with the classroom, and she'd take one of the boys back there to help her, and then there'd be some touchy-feely going on then too. Fifth graders, immature fifth graders as you would expect. Some were a little bit older because they were behind because of their language skills, but still very immature at that time. The bulk of the main offenses occurred actually at Sharpstown Movie Theater. She took two or three boys on a couple of different occasions to the movie theater, kind of as a reward thing, and at that location she performed oral sex on them in the movie theater. And also have them touching her inside her pants and her breasts as well. So it was a very egregious kind of case involving fifth grade students. Lots of sex acts. There was even one student she had become friendly with the mother, and during the summer after fifth grade, he actually came and stayed at her house, and that's when full intercourse occurred with her. And her husband also sexually abused that child. So, pretty awful. Anyway, the way that it all came to light was when one of the boys asked his social studies teacher, and this is either 7th or 8th grade, they were learning about the judicial system. Go figure, right? What happens when you rape a teacher was what the teacher thought the kid said, but it's not what the kid said. Because of the language issue, he was really saying, what happens if a teacher rapes you? And so that teacher actually reported it to one of the assistant principals. The assistant principal is a bilingual. She caught him in the hallway a little later and said, hey, what were you asking Mr. So-and-so about? And the kid, the floodgates opened, and he began to tell about what happened in fifth grade. So thank goodness for him. Fairly nice kid. Anyway, he said, yeah, it happened to these other kids. Gave their names. Only a couple were at that middle school with him. Others had gone other locations, but he and the others gave their names, so the police were able to contact them and determine the disclosure. Incidents were ongoing, occurred multiple times, and I talked to you about the one that was abused at her house. She was married. The twist in this is that she wasn't aware that her husband was sexually abusing that little boy while she was sexually abusing. So, yeah, they were each doing the kid. And the further twist on that is the kid had actually been sexually abused by his stepfather before fifth grade and had actually disclosed to her during the fifth grade year that he had been sexually abused by his stepfather. So he had a lot of issues going on with the prior sexual abuse, identity issues, so on and so forth. So anyway, she was charged with 5 cases of aggravated sexual assault and indecency. Right here I have the PSIs pending because I haven't updated, but she was actually sentenced to 40 years. It was by the court. She pled guilty. She actually gave a confession to the police. When they met with her and sat down, she wasn't really forthcoming. She didn't talk about as many times that it's happened because the kids said, basically this was going on daily in the classroom. She was minimizing, but she did admit to the offenses against him. 40 years, and of course got 20 on the indecency cases. Her husband was also charged, and he received 15 years from the court. Both pled guilty. So very interesting case. I will tell you that over the years what we've seen, because we've kind of been studying the punishment, and this was from the judge, it was in the 209th judgment, expanded the sentencing based upon the sentencing report. But we've seen, I've tried a lot of these to juries to just try to figure out what's the case worth. And this is a very egregious, this is probably one of the most severe cases that I've had. But we have a lot that are just like high school students with a high school teacher. There's maybe a 5 or 6 year age difference. So we've tried some of those to just kind of see what the juries are doing. Initially, they were given probation. And then we found they got a little bit tougher. And, you know, that kind of coincides with what the legislature's done law-wise, too. So, anyway, I'm not going to go over any other case studies, but anyway, that's just kind of a hot area that we've kind of paid attention to because of the attention it gets from the media and just from the general public as well. So, any questions about child victim testimony or anything like that, or anything else I can answer for you?
Yes. How often are you just not able to get the kids in court to testify?
You know, every once in a while. Every once in a while. There are issues and we have to dismiss the case. Because
will you dismiss it?
We'll dismiss if we can't go forward. Typically, we've got to have the child testify in criminal court. We do have closed circuit available, but typically they're going to have to testify. There's not going to be any other way to get that evidence in. And so every once in a while, there's those cases where maybe we feel like there's some issues, evidentiary or with their testimony, and so you know, we do dismiss those cases. And like I said, we decline quite a few. I mean, you can imagine the numbers that come through. Yes.
Are most of your cases small child cases, or are they teenage cases?
You know,
or is
really
it fairly split.
You know, I say split. Typically, in my division, we're doing the smaller kids because they're kind of harder. Teenagers can walk and talk easily and tell you about it and can be fairly graphic at times. You know, I don't really have any figures on that. So, you know, we take them as they come, but I do. Yes, sir.
In the DA's office, when you do the interviews of kids, do you keep a record of the times that they're interviewed, long, and who does it?
We do not. I mean, typically, you know, it's considered work product as it is with any witness that we meet before trial, our expert, the police officer, anybody like that. But typically, I always tell my lawyers, you don't interview the child alone. You typically have a support staff person in there, a paralegal investigator, another prosecutor, somebody else in there, in addition to the court advocate person typically. And time frame wise, you know, we're dealing with a volume system, so typically you're not ever going to spend 45 minutes doing an interview with a kid before. So the most that I've probably ever seen a kid before a trial is a couple of hours. And sometimes, you know, you'll get interrupted for whatever reason while you're talking to the kid and have to go take the time off or whatever. But no, it's not recorded. So we do have witnesses in there because sometimes we've got kids who outcry about either other sexual offenses that occur to them or other abuse, even other perpetrators. And so we don't want to make ourselves a witness. That's why we've got the support staff in there. And sometimes we go, time out, you know what, I think maybe they need to go back to the Children's Assessment Center and get another forensic interview because you're telling them some things I didn't know. So, you know, sometimes we'll just shut them up and send them back and get more of those details. Does that answer your question?
Yes. What percentage of the cases is there assigned a child advocate or advocate in children or child advocate or court advocate? Or how many of the cases are there?
The way that works in criminal cases is there's an organization for youth and married women's center called Children's Court Services. And basically they're the court buddies. We call them the court advocate, but they're basically the court buddies for the kids. They don't do therapy for them, they're not really involved in the facts of the case. They're there as a support system for them. You know, when they come down to court, they sit with them when they're waiting outside, sit with them, the family members that may be, or you know, if they're in custody, yes, they're there with them. If we're delayed getting the child on, testimony-wise, sometimes it may be half a day or a day. They make sure that they're, you know, entertained. They can bring books to, you know, color if that's their age, or DVDs to watch, or you know, whatever, so that they're not, you know, just sitting there. But as far as the percentage of those cases, a good number of those have Children's Court Services involved. It's up to the family or whoever's got custody of the child if they agree to have that person involved in the case.
I know they have to agree.
Yes, they have to agree. Thank you all very much. Yeah.
I just didn't want to interrupt.
Yeah, that's great.
And then another thing. Is there any way I can take a second? I forgot my, I lost my wallet, so I don't have any money. So we're getting dinner.
Yeah, don't stop. Take
that away. Sure. Is there an internship there in your apartment?
You do. I run probably one internship at Thomas because they really have to, so we don't have enough ready to stand, so we really do use
it. Pass on your money. That's why she said they can't do it unless the kids
are dead.
That's my dad's second.
Really?
Please apply for internships. We're always looking for internships. Lots of an intern.
Okay.
Good. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so fascinating. Would you like a drink? We've got lunch here. Would you like
one? Yeah, lunch.
Yeah, this is a turkey?
Yeah.
Is that good?
Okay. Yeah, let me just stick this back in the sleeve.
Would you like a hi, cheese?
Yeah, anything would be fine. Anything? Wouldn't have a dry.
Well, yeah.
No dog. Anything, no dog.
Okay. A 7-Up?
We've got 7-Up, we've got Sprite.
Sprite?
We got
Sprite. Gotcha, Sprite.
That's good.
So, you haven't had to, I mean, I guess most of the times you're able to get the kids to testify. I'm amazed at the 4-year-olds that works out.
Yeah, it does, surprisingly. I mean, you would think, that'd be like so hard. But you just have to realize how much they can do.
That's great. How much do you have to lead them, or are they able to really tell the stories?
You have to lead a little bit to some extent, because you can't really look at the parent, okay, and you need to tell me about them what happened the next day.
Right.
You know, so a little bit, but if you're not giving them the answers, you know, the judge and the defense isn't going to let you give them the answers. They've got to say, yeah, I got the question.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Right.
So
when they say you're allowed to lead certain witnesses, they don't mean totally telling the story.
No. Not gonna happen.
Yeah, yeah.
They've got to be able to tell a little bit. You know, some kids are hard because they can't tell you or they won't tell you.
Right.
I mean, we had one kid one time, and they were a little bit older. I want to say like 11, and they just couldn't say it. It was a pretty bad sexual abuse, but they can draw it.
Really?
We did closed circuit, and then they had to draw. So we had like a drawing of the anatomical body, and then they drew the parts on there, and then they, well, then what happened? Did somebody touch you somewhere? Yeah, where?
Right.
What did they touch you with?
Okay. So you gave it like a picture.
And then where did they touch you with?
Yeah, yeah.
And then did they put it on the outside or inside, or you know, and sometimes they're able to say a little bit more, but
right.
Anyway, so anyway, it's interesting, you know. It's like I said, I wouldn't be doing it that long if each case weren't a little more.
Yeah, that's amazing. So when you say the closed circuit, like after Crawford, are they still letting you do that, like with the defendant not present?
When I say closed circuit, what we're able to do is the kid will be in another room. It may even be another courtroom.
Yeah.
And the defendant will not be in the courtroom, but it's all hooked up by TV.
Mm-hmm.
So the defendant can clearly see the child.
Right.
The child can see the defendant if you need them to for identification purposes or something like that. But I don't necessarily always need the kid to see the defendant.
Yeah.
I've got him identified by other things. He's Uncle Joe. He's the only Uncle Joe in the family kind of thing.
But you have to prove that they would be like traumatized?
Yes. Yeah. And we have had some that have been denied by judges when we try to use closed circuit.
Yeah, especially older, right?
And I even had a little kid who, you know, I remember when we were doing the closed circuit hearing, they came in to the courtroom and they waved at the defendant.
Oh my.
And or waved out in the hallway or something like that.
Yeah.
The testimony came out. The judge says, you know, no, they're fine. They're waving.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
not traumatized.
Huh.
And we thought they'd be a little more reluctant to discuss, you know, because they still love the person and they don't really get the sexual abuse so much, depending on their age. So
that's so awful.
Yeah.
I was surprised that you said that teacher was one of the more egregious cases, since there wasn't actually any intercourse.
There was, with one boy there was.
Oh, there was.
With one boy there was. But the oral sex on fifth graders.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I know. It's horrible.
Yeah.
But I would think that kind
There'd
of
be a lot
quote unquote
yeah.
non-consensual stuff, you know, where kids are more brutalized.
But you don't see that with teachers.
Right. Oh, so that's what you meant. Because I would think you would see some really
case studies. It's all those case studies that have pulled in the teachers as perpetrators.
Yeah, yeah.
High school, middle school,
right.
Elementary school.
Right. Oh, gosh.
As you would imagine, the punishment is always more severe on the elementary school.
And just teachers in general, I would think. Maybe not the older ones.
Well, the first offenders, typically.
Yeah.
And so if you've only got one victim, then, you know, they're kind of like, I don't know, it's interesting to watch juries, because, you know, sometimes they're tougher than
they usually opt for jury sentencing.
They've got to in order to get probation.
Oh, really?
Unless they're getting the recommendation from us or from the court or something.
So do you just do a PSI before trial?
Or
do they not have one then?
A PSI is actually fairly unusual in the case where they go to the court for sentencing. So in that case, she would not have been eligible for probation from the court. Mm-hmm. He could have given her a deferred, because he would have deferred to finding her guilty, but he found her guilty. So she was not eligible for probation from the court.
Interesting.
So what are you teaching this semester?
Well, I'm teaching evidence. That's all I'm teaching this term. Cause
how many classes have it?
Just one. Just one class. Yeah, that's all I have this semester, because I'm doing some writing, so we have... Sometimes we get lighter loads.
And do you have some... how many teaching assistants do you have working for you, or do you have any? None?
No, none.
Oh,
I just have Amanda, my secretary.
When you do research and things like that...
I have one student who's working for me. He's wonderful on the research side,
good.
And then we have our folks in the library who can sometimes the students don't quite get what I need, and so we have like professional librarians our librarians are lawyers, and they're also trained librarians. So if there's something I need that's hard to find, like statutory stuff, you know, or legislative history or things like that, you know, it can be really hard for students.
Yeah, that's good that you have that.
Yeah.
We'll have to remember that. I wonder if that would help us out. Sometimes we're looking for legislative history and stuff. And our appellate people are like,
Oh, yeah. Let me know.
Because that does come up from time to time. What was the legislative history? I don't know. So are things good at the law school these days, other than a little water damage now and then?
No, they're really good. Really good.
Who is the dean of the law school now?
Ray Nimmer. He just became the permanent dean this past year. And he was one of my colleagues. So we did a national search, but he's...
Yeah, so that was good to have somebody from inside.
Yeah, that was. The dean before that had been brought in from Nebraska, and she was good for a while, and then it kind of ran its course.
Right.
It's good for stability to have
somebody.
And he's very good. I mean, you never find all the qualities that you'd like to have in an administrator, but he has some really important ones. He's very smart with budgets. And with assessing his staff's qualifications and whether they're doing a good job or not. He's really good at that.
That's good.
And he's very fair and organized. You know, so
excellent. Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for lunch, too.
You're welcome.
You know, we're usually running the cabin. But that's good. You had a nice turnout today.
Very good. There were some students taking notes. I'm thinking they must be doing a clinic or taking a class. And there were about six lawyers.
You know, people are, because of some of the stuff that came out in Kelly Siegler's campaign, the things that she said when she spoke to lots of people are very reticent to that.
I know.
Mm-hmm.
I could tell that was going through your mind. When I asked, that's why I was like, okay, I should have asked you sooner.
No, it's not a problem because, let's face it, every day we're standing up in front of groups and, you know, you have to be honest about things. And, you know, Kelly was one of those who, I don't know if you know her at all.
I've met her.
Yeah. She probably was a little more aggressive than some of us are.
I'm much
she made a name for herself that way, but
did.
It came back to bite her.
I'm much more conservative in the way I try case by try case. I don't want it to get reversed. I don't really want to have any issues on the field.
Yeah.
I don't want to make sure it sticks. So I'm going to do everything straight up.
I think there's a lot to be said for that.
I'm also one that I don't hide anything from defense. Good, bad, or different. I wanted to see it all out there because I know they've got it. It's bad. I figure out how am I going to deal with it. They've got it. If I were defense, I'd use it.
Yeah. Well, and like you say, you have enough cases.
That's it.
I mean, let them see it. If it's
you know what?
If it's that bad for you, maybe you shouldn't be prosecuting.
Exactly. And you know what? If we can't convict them this time, if they're bad enough criminals, they'll be bad, and we'll get them next time. So you can't worry about it.
One thing I never understood, though, people used to say about Kelly with that case where she brought in the bed and all that. I just thought, big deal. I mean, it's unusual because it's so big.
Very dramatic.
Yes. Very dramatic. But that's what you're supposed to. I mean, it's not that unusual to reenact something like how did the stabbing occur.
No, it was just the nature of that one was so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But right, I mean, don't you agree? Because sometimes I would hear like almost criticism that, you know, that she would go too far or something. And I thought, I don't see that, not with that. Maybe with other things,
maybe
but not
with, other things,
not with that.
But yeah, I mean, she was a good lawyer, obviously knew how to, you know, do the examination of witnesses and prepared well.
She'll be fine.
So, that's interesting.
She was in Fort Bend, right?
She lives or?
No, she was working, I thought.
She went down to help the elected try case in Wharton, I think.
On Wharton.
Yeah, because it was getting some attention in the Chronicle. Which I thought was a little unusual. It was a gay warden. So you can, I don't really know the facts, but it was a gay warden that was killed.
Getting the death penalty or something.
Yeah. And I'm like, boy, I think I like that gay warden today. So, I don't really know the facts, but it's not one that I'm sure. I think it got the attention because she was in it.
Yeah. So the stuff from the Children's Assessment Center, you don't even try to introduce that, right? But you do bring the witnesses in, or?
Yeah, typically the recorded statement from the kid at the Children's Assessment Center is not going to come into evidence. Every once in a while it does, but.
Or parts of it, maybe? Or?
Unusual circumstances. Maybe you're teaching the kid, maybe defense has made a big deal out of how the expert, the forensic interviewer, led the child or something like that, so then it will come in. But typically the child is also on the stand to testify. So. Yeah, in this jurisdiction, we've always handled that very conservatively because by and large, over the years, the kids have always testified. Other jurisdictions in the state,
they'll just, you know, they have some judges and just offer the
video of the kid. Admit it, play it.
Now you're asking for trouble, though.
Oh, yeah. But,
Crawford and all that. Supreme Court loves to take cases like that from Texas.
I know.
To show how,
I know how
bad.
Yeah.
Even though it probably happens other places, too, but.
But, you know, we've also been much more conservative than we've done it. Because I really. You know, the cases that we get reversed, really, in this jurisdiction, child abuse cases, few, at far between.
Yeah, and now that you mention it, I don't really see it very much.
No, not straight up reversals on issues. Every once in a while, there's some interesting area of the law that comes up.
Now, I didn't want to ask you in front of everybody, but, I mean, has it ever happened that you have a case, you can get your conviction, you move on? And then there's a recantation, and you find out, holy cow, this kid made the whole thing up. I just put somebody in prison.
We've had recantations, but there's still.
typically a reason for it. And so, you know, when you have a recantation like that, especially after the fact, and I've never had one personally where they recanted like that, because I usually...
But you haven't had any where they're, like, real, where, like, it never happened?
There have been a few that our post-conviction area has handled, but I don't think anything that's been reversed or anything on this issue. I mean, it has come up from time to time. They've dealt with that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they'll go out and talk to the kid or find out that maybe this was something that they really did recant about before trial even. Mm-hmm. And, you know.
Mm-hmm. So, because I remember a long, long time ago, there was a case in California.
Mm-hmm.
Remember it? Well, daycare center, bunch of little kids, were supposedly all victimized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then
the kids were recanted.
Well, it started coming out that maybe social workers or somebody mm-hmm. had kind of led the kids to create these stories.
Was it California or was it like North Carolina?
I could be wrong, but I thought it was California. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I mean, the idea was just that you could suggest something to a child mm-hmm. and they could fantasize about it and then lose track of reality versus fantasy.
It kind of went to the way that those kind of investigations were handled, because that's been a number of years. Very different. Yeah, child abuse has come a long way in 20
years. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you don't, like, that doesn't ever really come up so much. Like, there, in other words, I guess what I'm trying to figure out from you, from your experiences, are there situations where either teenagers mm-hmm. are mad at somebody
mm-hmm.
and they make something up, or there's a little kid who somehow somebody gets the idea in their mind
right.
about something, and so they sort of convince themselves.
And a lot of those started out even before charging. Mm. Because the cops are suspicious, you know. Okay, well, so this, you know, mm-hmm. it didn't, the logistics of it don't make sense, mm-hmm. or the physical ability to do that, or in that mode, or whatever.
And do they bring in specialized cops?
They are ones who are assigned to that area. When you say specialized, maybe they've got a little bit of training in that regard.
But that's like all they do.
Right.
So
they're considered detectives.
They have a lot of experience in
some do.
Cops.
Yeah, there's new, like
yeah,
the new ones.
Yeah. But I would think that, you know, even if you don't, if you have minimal training, but at least if you have an interest in the area and that's all you do, or that's a lot of what you do,
right.
that's going to help.
It does. It does. Well, and, you know, the cops, too, are not like, they're not out for blood on each case. They really want to, you know, say, and they'll tell you, I'm not sure this really happened.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and they're like, well, heck, you don't know.
Right.
How are we ever seen as a jury?
Right.
Hello. Hi. Hi. Oh, yeah, I didn't even know about it. You called me this morning. I called him back to let him know that I was going to do it. Well, don't worry. I suggested maybe next Monday, so can we just do that? Okay, honey. No big deal. All right, bye.
My
So how long have you been at your bed now?
Almost 19 years. So a long time like you.
mm-hmm. Yep. That's what people always kind of. It's just the old ones.
I know.
Time flies by.
Mm-hmm. I know, you don't feel that much older. You know?
But you feel more, don't you feel more of an expert? Mm-hmm. I mean, definitely. Like, just listening to you talk, I mean, you're just very authoritative.
Well,
and
sometimes
you get to know your
what
you do
so well.
I don't
know anything, and then sometimes if you talk to, you know, some of the new learners, you're like, yeah, I do know a few.
You do. You do.
Turn around a lot. A time or two.
Know a lot. So, are most people hoping for Lycos or breath, or mm-hmm. is there trepidation about both?
Probably about both.
That's what I would think, because she wasn't that popular as a judge.
She wasn't. I know her. I was chief in her court for a year.
Oh, you were?
Yeah. So, she didn't scare me.
But do you think she'll be okay? Do we know how it's going? I have no idea how that race is going. I haven't heard anything.
I think it really depends on, you know, what's going to pull in Harris County, Republicans or Democrats. And I think it's really, you know, there's a very strong Democratic vote out there.
I know,
this
I know.
That hadn't been. And so they think that may sway some of the top county spots.
Mm-hmm.
They're thinking county judges.
But then Ed Emmett was winning.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it was like. I think what it is if it's Harris County, the Republicans have a better chance. If it's Houston,
mm-hmm.
then
Democrats.
I think they don't.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't heard.
Typically, that's the way it's been, but I don't know. We'll see. I mean, the voting mm-hmm. numbers are just astronomical this time.
I know.
And so we'll all be, you know, glued to the computers and the TV sets tomorrow night, all of us.
Yep.
So.
Yep. Yep.
Just to see how it's going to turn out. It'll be interesting, and it'll be a interesting transition for the DA's office. But, you know, I always think change can be a very good thing sometimes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, forward thinking, new ideas.
It'll be interesting. I mean, Bradford was on the police side, so
mm-hmm.
he's not. I mean, like in Dallas, they have a former defense lawyer as their DA now.
A bondsman, actually, is where he was, yeah. Mm-hmm. So kind of
Watkins?
Mm-hmm.
He was a defense lawyer too, though.
Yeah, but a bonding is what he did as well. So.
Really?
Yes. Huh. But yeah, he came in and did a lot of changes because I knew my counterpart up there got nixed when he came in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so I don't know if it's because of who they were supporting or whatever during, you know, I don't really know the politics, but yeah, so they lost a number of. Senior experience people.
Yeah.
So they're a little topsy turvy for
example. Yeah. I don't know. That would be really dumb.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I mean, Watkins has done actually a lot of good stuff over there.
Yeah.
From where I sit.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Like I was going to ask you about that one X-ray case. I guess you were able to identify him because that was the only person in there. I mean,
it was
medical
the only
records.
Male tech, and the kid outcried almost immediately. She outcried when she was down in another area of the hospital to her mother.
Yeah, yeah. So that was.
And her mother didn't really know what to do. She was like totally freaked.
Yeah.
Because
I'm doing all kinds of work right now on eyewitness identification stuff. So,
oh, really?
So that's why I say Watkins is doing a good job because I think he's been paying attention to that. And I mean, there's some state-of-the-art procedures that are fairly simple to mm-hmm. adopt, you know. And most police departments around the country have completely ignored it, you know. And
so, like, what kind of stuff? Because you know, eyewitness usually the identity of our perpetrator, and so
right, you don't have that issue, right?
Mm-hmm. But you know, in different cases they do.
Yeah.
So what kind of stuff is out there then?
Well, the most common, I guess, thing to use is photo arrays. So there's a real, you know, and there's almost a preference for that over lineups even because, you know, now you can have access to these computer bases, databases that... Mm-hmm. where you can set up a photo array with people who really do look more alike.
Very similar, yes.
So you don't have people standing out. And
as opposed to a lineup, you've got to take like what's in jail.
You got to take what's in jail and all that, and it's usually a big mess.
Right.
Things like not asking leading questions to the witnesses ever.
When they're doing.
That's important.
Mm-hmm.
Documenting everything that happens. That's important.
Are they not recording a lot of that when they're doing the, well, the lineups they're recording?
And
I don't know if they're recording what the victim is saying.
HPD, you're saying? Is,
yeah, I don't know because
see,
because
the
really
things
that
they're
issue.
Just there are tens of thousands of independent police departments around the country.
Yes.
And HPD may be fabulous, and you know, Pasadena or somewhere else, you know,
yeah.
that's another story.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know, and yet they're doing important cases in all these departments. So, but like sequential. Showing sequentially as opposed to simultaneously.
Oh, okay. Should do that?
Yes.
Oh.
Because what happens is there's a psychological phenomenon called, I'm going to forget, relative, something earlier. Okay, I forgot now.
Like
relative judgment, I think, mm-hmm. is what it's called. And what a person will do is just basically find the person that they think most closely matches, as opposed to this is the guy.
Right.
And then that image of the person they pick gets sort of replaces the image that they had, which was maybe fuzzy, and now it becomes much more concrete, and it becomes that person in their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And the worst thing is if the officer says, yeah, that's the guy. You know, that's right, that's the person we arrested.
Yeah.
Now their confidence level, like even if
right.
they say, oh, I think that's him,
mm-hmm.
and you know, mm-hmm. if you were to follow up and say, how sure are you? You know, you would get like an answer like, you know, 40% or something.
Yeah.
But now if you tell them, yeah, that's the guy, they go to court and they say, I'm 100% sure I would never forget the
right.
face.
Right, right.
And that's how
so
a lot
you just
of,
have to be careful in the way that they are.
Well, with the there are a lot of different things, but like, sequential versus mm-hmm. simultaneous, and what they call blind administration, which is when the investigating officer doesn't know who was arrested, and when the officer doing the ID tells the witness, I don't know,
and they don't know,
and also telling them, and by the way, if you don't select someone, the investigation will continue. Because a lot of witnesses are going to be afraid that if they
it'll
don't
just be over.
Yeah, if they don't pick one of them, then they're going to drop the case.
Right, right, yeah.
So things like that, you know, they're not that hard.
Well, I've always been a big proponent on when the police do things, it should be recorded. Because you know what? If something bad happens, we want to know too.
Yeah.
We want to know because, you know, if it needs to be, the case needs to
right.
be flushed. We want to flush it. We want to do what's right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, way back when, before they were really recording the kids' interviews and stuff mm-hmm. like that, I was a big proponent of that. Like, oh, no, you know, some of those interviewers, they ask terrible questions, and the kid doesn't say what they're on. And I'm like, you know what? If good, bad, or indifferent, we need to know.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, you know, defense is going to see that. You know what? It's okay. If it's a bad case, we need to flush it.
Right.
And if there are bad things out there that, you know, the way the question was done, then we need to deal with those issues if we want to proceed to
yeah.
prosecute it.
And, I mean, how, from your perspective, how burdensome would it be to require videotaping of photo arrays and things like that?
Well, I think they could do it.
I think
they
so,
just,
too. I can't imagine
well,
that it would be that hard.
Well, you know, I don't know if you recall, but a couple of years ago, we had the issue with the child medical exam here in Harrison County. There was a same nurse that was over at the Children's Assessment Center that mm-hmm. was over and undercalling some of the medical exams.
She was what now?
Over and undercalling. You know, what? She'd say, you know, evidence of sexual abuse was there when she was in
oh,
the kid,
oh, oh,
and it really wasn't.
I see.
Either based upon
oh,
her lack of expertise or so and so forth. But and not every one of those cases was reviewed by physicians with expertise because they're not required to when they're a same nurse kind of thing.
Oh, boy.
So when this whole thing came to light and we had all those cases then peer reviewed, flushed the ones that we couldn't make, you know, kept the ones that we could, we had photographic evidence. It was when UT was over, had the contract over there. And so they were photographing.
Mm-hmm.
Video recording the exam with a colposcope, and then they have still photos too. And then, of course, you have the written record. So you had all of that to go back to review when you were doing it. You'd see exactly
yeah.
from the, you know, when they're first looking at the child and the genitalia and their hands were there or,
mm-hmm.
you know, whatever scope they were using or so, speculum or whatever. And, mm-hmm.
So when the contract changed over there from UT to Baylor, we wanted that as a written protocol, that every case done there would be photographically documented, video or still photos or so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And they were not willing to agree to that because, you know, it was kind of like Big Brother looking mm-hmm. over the shoulder mm-hmm. grading your paper every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so they wouldn't agree to that. Mm-hmm. But because we had just had the DNA crime lab issue occur mm-hmm. at the DA's office, I made a suggestion that, you know what, we need to, if they won't agree to the policy, this to be the protocol for what should be done on these cases, then we need to do something. And it was my bureau chief at the time, who has since retired, who said, we need to do legislation then. Mm-hmm. And because of the fiscal note, if we had tried to do it statewide, because not everybody has the state-of-the-art facilities that we do here with the colposcope and
right.
so
right.
on and so forth, that the fiscal note would have been too great. Because, you know, Potentville, we had to get them a colposcope and
right.
somebody who could
right.
use it and all that kind of stuff. And so we did it for jurisdictions our size or larger.
Huh.
And it's now on the books that if it's a child sexual assault exam is done in this jurisdiction, that it has to be documented, and you have to do photographic evidence, and if it is not, it must be documented in the medical record as to why it wasn't done.
Yeah.
And that it's admissible at trial why it wasn't done. So it's been very, very helpful.
Yeah.
And to be quite honest with you, since we have done that, it's been on the books, the medical experts that we're seeing from defense are few and far between. They'll come in, mm-hmm. they'll look at the photographic mm-hmm. evidence, review the medical records,
yeah.
and we never see him in trial.
Right, right. Huh. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's...
It makes for better evidence.
Better evidence, and it's just, it's all out there to
right.
be reviewed.
Right.
And, you know, we open the experts from the defense side with open arms and say, yeah, we'll have it over here in our office for you to view. And even on some cases, because the expert's in another jurisdiction, out of state or whatever,
yeah.
we go with defense, they'll get a court order that be sealed and sent to that expert for review and sent back afterwards.
And, yeah, I mean, the way that the technology is now, it's so cheap. I mean, everybody's got... most everybody has a cell phone in their purse or pocket that can videotape something. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like not that
well,
hard. Come
and
on.
And here's the thing, too. When you think about even the criminal cases, the amount of surveillance and mm-hmm. stuff that's done, you need to meet with somebody.
Yeah.
I'll let you go. There's so much more. I mean,
yeah.
like, the other day I was walking in my kid's elementary school, and I remember when he started there 4 years ago, I thought, you know, they were really lax because they
Insecurity.
Weren't even scanning the driver's license for
right.
sex offenders and
right.
stuff like
right.
that. I mean, we're in a pretty secluded area. It's a public elementary school, but still.
Right, right.
And I thought the way they had the drive-through for the parent pickup, the where mm-hmm. it was near the classrooms, they didn't have that gated or locked off during the day. There were little pre-Kers and kindergartners back there that anybody could walk and say, hey, hop in the car, mom.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it just, you know, and so now they kind of changed all that. And the other day I walked in the front entrance and my kids said, hey, mom, look, see up there, you're on video.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have surveillance cameras in there before. And
mm-hmm.
they do on some of the hallways and stuff
yep,
like that.
Yep, yep.
And he was showing me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, one of the cases I just read on the identification stuff, there was a camera outside the convenience store. That's how they got the guy.
Yeah.
You know, because usually you see them inside. But
well, and even shopping areas and stuff like that, even though it's a far distance, sometimes you can zoom that in, or if you bring
yeah.
in certain technology to,
yeah.
you know, try to get it better identified,
yes.
but you can take the camera from Walmart way across to that gas station
and do
these camera way more.
It just takes a little more investigation.
Right.
And that's one of the things I've been talking about in this area. It's like, you don't have to have such shoddy identifications. You know, you can do a little more investigation and get something. You know, I think there's probably a lot ATM records, credit card records, you know.
Things like that.
Surveillance.
Well, and here's the thing,
other
too.
Other witnesses.
When you think about the cases that someone might have got convicted for misidentification, that's scary as all get out.
They're all robberies.
It's scary as all get out.
I'm studying this stuff.
It's all
They're
robberies.
Robberies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's 220 rape cases so far, like in the last 10, 15 years. Where they've been exonerated,
mm-hmm.
they're all rape cases. Every last one of those DNA cases, there's a rape in it. It might be a murder also, it might
okay.
be a burglary also,
okay.
they're all rapes.
Mm-hmm.
There's four times as many robberies. And those cases have, they're strangers, you know.
That's the guy.
If it's cross race, it's much worse quality identification. They have all this, you know, the confirmatory feedback. Yeah, that's the guy. You know, all this bad stuff going on. Mm-hmm. And you read the cases, and some of them I just shake my head and I go, you know, I just cannot. Knowing what I know about how bad that ID was, how did this guy get convicted? You know, I mean, I cannot.
You have to look at the jurisdiction where it's coming from sometimes. Sometimes it's like people just want to find somebody who did it.
Well, now, and in a lot of them, you know, there's other evidence, too.
Right, right.
But then you have others that you just.
It's not good. Yeah.
It's like, oh, he had time to change his shirt. And,
I know.
You know, this kind of thing.
You just have to look at that. And, you know, I know the DA's office may have a different reputation, but I'm almost like, flush the case. We can't prove it. We're not sure. It's over.
Yeah.
We'll get him next time.
Exactly.
They'll be back. If they're bad, they'll be back. Yeah. Anyway, I'll let
you
go.
Thank you so much.
I enjoyed it.
It was great.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Nice to see you again.
Okay, good to see you.
Let me just give her my thing.
Okay.